Thank you for joining us at the i3 Detroit Hour. Coming up, Ben Chun teaches computer science in San Francisco. He and I discuss the challenges of teaching computer science at a high school level and his Kickstarter initiative to make the task easier for teachers everywhere. Then we have a chance to hear from three of the i3 Detroit teammates competing in the Red Bull Creation Challenge as they recap a successful 16-day binge to build a time-traveling radio. All music we use in our program was found online under the Creative Commons license. To learn more about the music used in our program, please email us at contact@i3detroit.com. Thanks, and please enjoy the show. This is i3 Detroit.
And a 1, 2, 3.
I almost imagine that there's this continuum or spectrum of kinds of knowledge from like electrical engineering to library science. And computer science reaches, you know, almost all the way in both of those directions.
You don't have to be an author to read a book, and you don't have to be a lawyer to understand your rights. In that same spirit, you don't have to be a coder to learn how software works. Today on the i3 Detroit Hour, you will hear from Benjamin Chun, a high school computer science teacher in San Francisco. He has taken on a big challenge to provide an illustrated guide to the big ideas of modern computer science. Flow control, classes, and functions are just a few of the big ideas that Ben refers to as computational thinking, which is the elemental reasoning skill that coders use to write software. Ben's illustrated guide aims to show that computational thinking is something everyone can learn and apply, even if you never touch a compiler. Following that, sit down and hear from a few members of i3 Detroit's Red Bull Creation team. Word on the street is, they've got a radio that travels through time, and somehow they did it with an Arduino. It's all coming up on the i3 Detroit Hour. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. My name is Ross Smith. I'm with the i3 Detroit Hour here on Signal. On the phone with me today, I have Ben Chun. He teaches computer science in San Francisco, California. And he's working on a very interesting project to help teach computer science concepts to high schoolers.
Hi, Ross.
Hi, Ben. Now, maybe a good point to start at, is before we get into the project you're working on with Kickstarter and your artist correspondent in New York, is to tell us a little bit about what you do actually as a computer science teacher in high school.
Yeah, okay. So I teach at a public school here in San Francisco called Galileo Academy of Science and Technology, which sounds pretty fancy, but is actually just a regular comprehensive public high school that you don't have to apply to, and you might just end up getting assigned to if you didn't pick your high school specifically. It was renamed, I don't know, I guess maybe sometime in the 80s from being Galileo High School to the Galileo Academy of Science and Technology. But our graduation requirements and all of our required classes and everything are the same as every other high school in San Francisco.
Okay, so you do offer things like AP courses and such, but you don't have any unusual graduation requirements.
Right. Now, not every high school in San Francisco, and certainly not every high school in the U.S. even offers computer science or AP computer science. I think the number is about 10%. I think about 10% of U.S. high schools have an AP computer science class.
You know, honestly, that seems kind of high to me. I was blown away when I heard there was a dedicated computer science class in a high school, and I thought, oh my God, why couldn't I have had that? It sounds like so much fun.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I feel the same way because I didn't have computer science when I was in high school either, although I'm sure I would have loved it and wanted it if it had been available.
Yeah, so it sounds like it's sort of an uncommon position for you to be in, and you're teaching what I consider to be, personally, as a programmer, pretty advanced thinking, you know, and pretty sophisticated concepts, and you're leading high schoolers in a certain direction of abstract thought, which to me is immensely encouraging. I think we could always use more programmers. What is it like? What is it like helping students wrap their head around some of the weirdness? And what's some of the language that you use to even talk about these things that we do in computer science?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think everybody who's a programmer, especially when you would get groups of programmers working together, people sort of end up developing their own maybe private vocabularies that are based on and related to the mainstream academic or industrial way that people talk about programming. But we all develop our own little subcultures and quirks. And I guess, you know, my classes in the school are no different than anywhere else. we do talk about a lot of things in sort of standard ways. We use the Java terminology for talking about objects and instance variables, I guess, which are like fields, and we call them methods instead of functions because that's what you call them in Java. So, you know, those sorts of things, we end up using kind of the standard vocabulary, but you always also end up kind of, and I found this when I was a professional programmer as well, that you end up sort of personifying these abstract ideas because, otherwise they're just too hard to get a grip on, I think, for anybody, particularly for people who are having their first experiences with really abstract, really heavy abstract, kinds of ideas.
Absolutely. And it's a very good point, actually, that even advanced or, you know, fully professional programmers, they do come up with ways of characterizing a class versus a function and how the classes interact as combative or doing shotgun surgery or, you know, those sorts of things.
Right. Or, you know, you're asking for, you know, what does this method return? And so we say, oh, well, look, it spits this thing back or it bails out early. And we use these kind of like evocative descriptions of things, I think, in a way to help us kind of keep track of what's going on. It needs to be a little bit more lively and exciting to keep it all straight in your head.
Definitely. And that's actually, that relates a lot to this project that you've started on Kickstarter that I find so fun and so compelling. And I just had to give some of my own money to it. But I also wanted to help sort of this message get out for helping people in high schools, whether they're teachers like you or students, wrap their heads around some of, you know, these abstract concepts and the terminology that goes with that. And I guess from there, I'd like it if you described what you're doing to help kids learn these abstract concepts.
Yeah, well, thanks for your support on that. The idea is really something that it's based on my own experiences as a kid, and I think that you know, in talking to a lot of people, there are a lot of programmers today who had these books as kids, and the books were like, how does a computer work on the inside? And if you go back to the 80s, anytime you saw a book about computers or computer science, they sort of felt the need to describe how a microprocessor works. Mm-hmm. And they would go into the detail of there being like an instruction bus and a data bus, and then there's a CPU, and they would, you know, they would kind of personify, again, embody with little cartoon characters or whatever these abstract ideas. And, you know, there were not literally little robots on motorcycles driving around inside of my computer. I knew
that. Right. But how much easier did it make to visualize what was going on? Yes.
It absolutely helped, you know, and I think also there were some influential video games and, you know, thinking back on our own educations or how you and I maybe came to discover the way that these concepts work or how to reason or think about what computers and machines that compute things, how are they working and what are the limitations and restrictions that they're running up against? What are their mechanisms of operation? It really helped to have these kind of guides, and they were visual guides that really helped. And so there's a couple of books by a guy named Larry Gonick, I think, called Computer Science Illustrated. It's just a whole book that was basically kind of like a cartoon guide. And he actually ended up doing a cartoon guide to everything. He did like a cartoon guide to US history, a cartoon guide to physics. You know, he did like the cartoon version of everything.
Oh, wow, cool.
So it's kind of fun. And that was a book from the 80s that, you know, maybe some people remember. And then Usborne, the publisher, did a whole series of books in the 80s that had cartoons that sort of explained different things about how computers work. And so in thinking about those things and thinking back to those, I realized that we really don't have those kinds of illustrations now. There's no book that kids are reading. I mean, geez, I don't even know if people are giving kids books anymore. But like, if they are, I'm pretty sure that there are no books that have cartoons that are representing the object-oriented programming ideas. There's a heap, and when you construct an object, it gets memory allocated, but that happens automatically. And then you get a pointer to it, but that's not really a pointer. It's a reference. What even are these things? They're abstractions built on top of abstractions built on top of abstractions, and mm-hmm. somewhere an electron goes through a transistor.
That's exactly it. Yeah, that's the end terminus where you can say, this is what the physical reality looks like, and so far removed from what you're talking about that, yeah, how do you cross all those levels, those layers of abstract activity?
Right.
You're exactly right. I mean, no one's going to give a kid a book these days, right now at least, that outlines this in a clear visual way that's also technology agnostic. And we can get into that later, but I want to talk more about the specific language choices that you have and some of your goals when you teach kids in the classroom. But we haven't gotten to the big reveal yet, so go on.
Oh, okay. So here's the pitch. It's to actually create these kind of cartoons that explain the big ideas today in computer science. And it's a harder task, I think, than it's ever been, specifically because of these layers of abstraction that we were talking about. I think in the 80s, it was a little bit easier to say, okay, well, here's assembly code, you know, and that's really just an abstraction over these logic gates, which are really formed out of these transistors. Bam, there you go. That's it. Now we've got at least a couple more layers on top of that, and so it may not be as important to talk about the transistors now, particularly when we're thinking about object-oriented languages that were designed to hide some of the things like memory allocation, and yet they require and regularly use their own set of metaphors. Like construction or the life cycle of an object. We talk about an object being born and being destroyed. And there are, you know, sort of more or less technical ways to talk about it. I mean, sometimes people will say things like, yeah. And so when there are no more references, the object goes away or it gets garbage collected. I mean, these are all, again, sort of metaphorical things, which you could dream up any kind of imagination that you want of like what is happening when things are being garbage collected. Are there little guys running around picking up trash? How do they know it's trash? Are there trash cans? Are there trucks?
Yep.
I mean, maybe there are and maybe there aren't.
But it's because the technology has advanced, the industry has advanced at such a pace that, like you're saying, these primers and these guides, they don't really exist because of how quickly and how in many directions and how many layers the industry has changed. And if you want to bring people in to a point where they can presumably be employable in that industry, you know, you want a shortcut to the things that they're going to use. Not that all of the layers underneath are less meaningful because they have to be there to support those higher abstractions, but you kind of want to cut to the chase and teach that meat before you backtrack and say, this is how it boils down to transistors. Those intermediate illustrated guides, they don't exist for these high-level concepts now.
I think that's exactly the problem that we're trying to address with this project. Now I don't want to sort of shortchange other recent efforts that have been made in this direction, but the opportunity that exists right now is specifically around this new I guess it's this new language that people are using about computational thinking. And that's really taking a step back from programming and saying, what is the significance of the fact that we have made all of these programmable things in our world? What has really been the impact of that? And going forward, what can we do with that? So the College Board and the National Science Foundation are sort of partnering to pilot this new course that they hope will become an AP course. And it's being piloted right now at 5 universities around the country, one of them being UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And the course at UC Berkeley is called The Joy and Beauty of Computation.
Oh, what a title. Wow.
Which I think is a great name for a course. Great professor over there, Dan Garcia at UC Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And they're basically trying to come up with a computer science course for non-majors as a first course. Now, I also think that this is probably a great intro course for majors in the field. But the idea of expanding computer science to welcome more people to learn about these concepts, I think is a good one. And if we're bringing in more people to learn about these things, I actually don't care if they can really reason about the electrical properties of the transistor. That's really not what's important about functioning in a world where you have programmable computers.
That's exactly it. You can appreciate what's going on around you better if you have a course which shows you these are how these machines work generally, right? So you mentioned that you used the language of Java in your classroom, but you also mentioned through this project that you have this computational artifacts and computational thinking. And that's taking the whole thought of our programmatical, our computational world and saying, you know, take the technology layer out of it. Just see how and why these machines work and what they're doing for you. By offering a course like this, I love it. I love the thought of this because it implies, you know, like you don't have to be an English major to read literature, right? You don't necessarily have to be a computer scientist to appreciate what computers do and how they operate.
Exactly. No, you've hit it on the head right there. Computer science doesn't need to be just for computer scientists. And in fact, with computers being so pervasive, it almost verges into the realm of democracy. Like, we need people to understand how these machines work so that, one, they don't get turned against you.
True. That's a very good point.
So that you don't find yourself at a significant disadvantage to the people who do understand how the machines work. And I'm not talking about how to use Microsoft Word or how to check your email. I mean, what is the power of the computer, the power of computation, to help you deal with the information that you find out in the world, the information that confronts you on a day-to-day basis.
Yes. And certainly, as a professional programmer and having that experience, you know the desperation, the huge gap that really exists right now between the people who, you know, by their own motivation for professional interests or hobby interests, come to understand how computers work, how to work with them, how to program them, what they can do and what they cannot do. Those people with those heaped interests on one end of the spectrum and on the other far end, the people who choose not to investigate it or look at it too closely, it's such a wide gap right now. And that always, it stumped me, you know, it doesn't seem like a good thing. People really should be more aware of what their computer can do for them, and they should be more able to make the computer do those things for them.
Yeah, well, you used an interesting word there, which is you know, choose and don't choose. And I think that those choices are really strongly influenced by the world that people find themselves in. So I think it would be a mistake if we just said, gosh, I really can't figure out why some people really just don't take the time to learn this stuff. Mm. I think that there's a lot of cases where people are pushed away or actively turned off to the subject. And it doesn't have to be malicious. Mm. But I think about this a lot as a teacher, is that whether or not it's intentional, I have to take responsibility for the outcome of what happens. At the end of the day, if students leave and they're like, yeah, God, that computer stuff, it's just, there's all this stuff that I don't care about in there. I have to be really careful about whether I'm going to say, well, they don't care about those things and therefore they're just going to suffer for it. Or I have to ask myself have I presented things that really don't matter? Does it matter if they can figure out the electrical properties of a transistor or if they can do all these crazy logic problems in their head? Is that what matters about this? I have to be really careful in asking myself what I'm presenting, how I'm presenting it, and whether that's working for the people that I want to reach, which is everybody.
Exactly. And you've come around on something I very much wanted us to arrive at and to talk about, which is what your goals are as you teach computer science to high school students. We've, in the course of this conversation, we've explored the many different ways you could use a computer or think about computers professionally or avocationally or, you know, as a thing that's in the world that you should be aware of. What are your particular goals then? As you are a teacher and as you face this question every day in the classroom and you face students who are at differing levels of interest, what do you want them to take away from this experience?
Yeah, I mean, it's really an unusual position to be in these days as a teacher. We're in the era of standardized testing and sort of state-dictated curricula that tell you, you know, these are the subjects within geometry that matter and that sort of thing. But with computer science, it's very, very open.
Oh, yes.
And on the flip side, it's also not required at all. So you can graduate from high school in California having never touched a computer, and the state of California thinks that that's perfectly fine.
Wow.
Let that one sink in for just a minute. You can graduate from high, you can get your diploma, and there is no requirement in there that you've ever touched or operated a computer. Now there's a lot of political reasons for that and economic reasons for that, and it's tricky. But what it means is that computer science as a subject is more or less outside of the purview of the state. It gives us a lot of freedom, and with that, I guess, comes a lot of responsibility within the subject. Now, academically, if you look at universities and things, ask a bunch of computer science professors to agree on what computer science is and is not, and you'll get as many answers as you have professors.
Mm-hmm.
Different universities house their computer science departments in different orientations, and there's all these different configurations. I've seen computer science in the high school level filed under the math department, filed under the business department, filed under technology, whatever that is, as if that were somehow separate from all the other things.
Right.
You know, and so there's really you know, there's a very broad set of things that could possibly fall into the area of computer science. So the spectrum is very open.
It's open and it's multidimensional in exactly the way you described. For instance, my wife has a master's degree in what at her school was called management information systems, which has to do with computing and data management in a business setting, specifically for operating an office. And of course, you can go to school these days and learn computer science and its various, you know, ilk and languages for embedded systems development, for vital systems like for programming, you know, pacemakers if you wanted to, everything all the way up to programming very high-level systems that operate on terabytes of information, you know, distributed across maybe multiple servers, quote-unquote, in the cloud, you know.
Yep.
As the industry continues to grow and change in real time, you know, that's something that I wonder about. How do you track that? How do you teach something which is continually evolving? And is the goal to make someone ready to work in that world, or is it just to get them ready for what their world will be like in 10 years?
Well, I think, first of all, there's no way to get them ready for what the world will be like in 10 years. My goal is really to produce, to help students get to a point where they're able to keep up with this changing world.
Mm-hmm.
As it changes. And that really means learning how to learn stuff. And the stuff is complicated and maybe a little flaky here and there. Things don't always work exactly the way that you hoped, or you run into differences between theory and practice. And how do you kind of work your way through being logical and kind of deducing things, mm-hmm. but at the same time being practical, like being an engineer. So I almost imagine that there's this continuum or spectrum of kinds of knowledge from like electrical engineering to library science.
Mm-hmm.
Where we're talking about like how information is organized and classified and how do you find things you're looking for. And computer science reaches, you know, almost all the way in both of those directions. All the way down to the transistors and all the way up to the taxonomies. So how do you pick some area within there is a really hard question. For me, a lot of it is decided by participating with the AP exam. And that gives me a lot of guidance around, you know, what my students need to learn in Java specifically. And building up to that and picking that as a, you know, as a kind of a center of the sorts of things that they're going to learn. I guess I want them and I want to teach them in ways that that will make them able to be problem solvers. And so that doesn't necessarily mean they're ready to go out and get a job mm-hmm. as a software engineer. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be some like a data artist. It doesn't mean that they're even necessarily going to go into a technical field.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess what I'm wanting to teach is the way of thinking that's informed by how computers work, which is very useful for figuring out how to make a computer do what you want, but is also equally applicable in other domains of problem solving.
That makes perfect sense, and that's right on the money from everything I've heard when I've spoken to other teachers. I've had the opportunity to talk to some teachers who work at a magnet school here in Michigan called Roper, and they are very experienced academics who have been administering or teaching at this particular school for a combination of something like 50 years between the two of them. And we went over some concepts like we're talking about now, like what do you aim to teach your students, what are your challenges, what are your victories, and something they kept coming back to is that the content will change. The material in the class is going to continually change as science advances when you're teaching a science class, or as, you know, other areas continue to evolve and adapt in the world. What you're really teaching the kids are skills, and those skills are ones they're going to live with the rest of their lives. And if you can instill in them that logical thinking, even a bit, you know, to assist them in other areas of life, then you're definitely on the money. That's awesome.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess we could make an analogy here to computer science in the same way that there are functions and then there are higher order functions. There's like skills and then there are higher order skills, like meta skills, the skill of acquiring more skills or knowledge. Mm-hmm. I guess that's the one that we're all hoping to work on the most. And at the same time, load in relevant background knowledge that makes that skill more powerful.
Absolutely. And of course, talking in the language of Java and referring to Java as a language, those are all good things to have in that background so that when they hear those words, they're like, oh, yes, I do know what that is. So,
absolutely. And then, you know, I only really teach in this one language, but when they go and learn a second language or a third language, as they will inevitably if they continue to pursue computer science, I think there are huge light bulbs that go on. And if you interview programmers and talk to them, you know, most people say like, oh yeah, you know, around the second or third time I saw how to iterate over a data structure in one language or another, I sort of realized that the data structure isn't the words I'm typing. And it's not even really the bits that are being stored there. It's the idea of a data structure mm-hmm. and the concept of iterating over it. That's what matters. That's what I'm going to take with me and be able to translate real world problems into computationally approachable problems by using that concept.
Exactly. Using the concept instead of the language. I hope I'm not misattributing this quote here, but I think I read it in Code Complete. The author said something to the effect of, you know, you're progressing as a programmer when you stop thinking about programming as something that you do with a language and that you program yeah. into a language. You know, you bring your background knowledge of how you solve problems in the abstract, and then you learn the syntax and you learn the linker and the other things about how the language is compiled and how it runs. And you program into that language. You bring the structure and you bring the order to it because of how you know how to solve these problems.
That's a great way of putting it. I mean, that's exactly right. And so another goal with these computer science illustrations is to give people some kind of visual home for these more abstract ideas mm-hmm. so that it doesn't have to be pinned on those keywords from that one language that they're learning.
Yes.
That something else that you could hold in your mind at the same time, like robots on motorcycles going down little tracks that represent buses, or turning little cranks that represent the operations of a machine sort of going through a clock cycle. All of these kinds of visual things that you can hold on to, they remind you that it's not just that one keyword that you're typing. It's not just that one IDE that you're using, that there's some more general way of or just different lens or different view of thinking about this thing. So it's my hope with pursuing these computer science illustrations for the larger computational thinking concepts that as students are being introduced to more advanced subjects like parallel processing and multi-threaded execution, as they're being introduced to these earlier and earlier, that we're also giving them these cartoon or other kind of visual places to locate their understanding of those concepts, that it doesn't have to be just the word thread.
Exactly. And locate, that's a very good expression. This is when it's written down and it's visual, it's a marker for their memory. They can come back to in the future if they have an illustration, they can flip to a page. You know, for people who have more of that tactile memory, you know, they can come back and recall a concept when they have something they can literally see and then picture and carry around with them mentally.
Yeah, I hope that's what happens. And you know, it's another thing that's really important to us about this work is that we're licensing all these illustrations under Creative Commons because we'd like people to be able to use them in the ways that are going to work the best for them. So if you need to take one of these characters out of the scene they're in, or if you need to add you know, new things into the picture to sort of make it make sense. It's not only like, oh, I guess you could do that because you're a teacher and nobody's going to sue you and you'll maybe get away with it. It's like, we want people to do that, and we're licensing it in a way that's hopefully deliberately encouraging that kind of interaction and interplay with the drawings that we're putting out there.
Absolutely. And I think as other teachers see this project and they understand that interplay is possible, they may want to add to it. They may think, oh, there's this one particular idea that I think would be perfect right here. You know, maybe between these two, I could add this and accompany this description, and the project could then, you know, really take on its own life. It's a very exciting idea, and I think you're doing excellent work. It's very ambitious, and I hope it succeeds well.
Thanks, Ross. The response on Kickstarter has been kind of overwhelming. Looking at it, in the first, let's see, we put it on for 30 days, so 12 days have passed. In 18 days to go is what it says on my screen right now. In 12 days, we've gotten $3,600 from 75 different people, a number of which it's like their first time, you know, doing anything on Kickstarter. So it's just really, you know, really encouraging to feel like that there are these people out there, even though I'm the only computer science teacher in my school. And a lot of times I feel like, gosh, who am I going to talk to about these things? That you know, there are people out there who are thinking the same way, who are interested in this stuff, and who are willing to, you know, throw in a few dollars to support it. So it's been really amazing so far.
Definitely. Well, it's a latent need. You know, you've introduced an idea that when people see, you know, and they're in a position to teach or to think about teaching computer science, they see this idea immediately, you know, it crystallizes, and they know this is something that could really help. So the need is definitely out there, and by putting that foot forward and getting the word out about this program, we're going to meet a lot of needs in a lot of places, I think.
Well, thanks, Ross. I hope so.
Yeah. Ben, it's been a big pleasure talking to you, and I hope that maybe I can have you again on the program later, and we can talk about how the program is going.
It would be wonderful. I'm looking forward to reporting back to you on how things turn out.
All right. That sounds good. Ben Chun is a computer science teacher in a high school in San Francisco, California. You can give to his project on Kickstarter.org. And where else can they find more about the illustration project, Ben?
I guess Kickstarter is Kickstarter.com.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
You look for computational thinking illustrations. Computational thinking is the new kind of like broader term that encompasses computer science plus.
You mean plus plus.
No pun intended. Exactly. Other places that you can find me online, on Twitter, follow Ben Chun. That's BENCHUN. And my teacher blog, where I write about my thoughts about teaching computer science, is called It Moves. And it's at itmoves.wordpress.com. That's a little shout out to Galileo, the namesake of my high school, who supposedly said, "And yet it moves," when he was forced by the Spanish Inquisition to admit that that the sun was not, in fact, the center around which the earth rotated.
Great and memorable words. Ben, thank you again.
Okay, take care.
Hey, Johnny America, are you tired of listening to the same 10 songs played over and over on your local radio station? But we have the perfect product for you! Introducing the latest from Tarmus, a subsidiary of i3 Detroit and the Red Bull Creation Challenge, the Chronotune! Modeled after the Philco 90s series cathedral-style radio popular in the 1930s, the Chronotune has that desired vintage look and exciting new features! This radio will take you wherever you want to go in time. From Mozart to Madonna, from the Big Bang to the Big Crunch, you can listen across the span of time. Simply turn the dial to the desired year and enjoy the sounds of the day. And we do mean sounds, not just radio programming. The Chronotune picks up whatever you can hear.
Eastern folks, are you tired of living in the East? Then travel the Oregon Trail. Warning, may cause dysentery.
This amazing vamping of vintage radio continues the theme of incorporating the new with the old by featuring both an analog dial display and a Nixie tube-style digital display. Unlike traditional vacuum tube Nixies, the Chronotune solid-state tube readout requires less power and is available in many colors. The Chronotune contains advanced electronics powered by Arduino with AVR technology. Call now and order yours for 23 easy payments of $3 million. You too can own yours.
Chronotune.
Phone number not available at this time.
Eric Merrill.
Nate Bazanson.
Ted Hansen.
Eric, Nate, and Ted are participating in a competition known as the Red Bull Creation Challenge, and I'd like to let them introduce that to you and describe what it is the Creation Challenge is, how we got involved in this competition as a hackerspace, and what they decided to do with it.
And I should note, we have a missing member, Roger, but kind of good thing he's missing because we don't have another microphone for him.
Yes, this worked out perfectly, yes. So, Eric, could you begin by telling us a bit about how we got involved with the Red Bull Creation Challenge? It all started with a, what was it, a puzzle wrapped in an Enigma and a laser-cut wooden box or something like that?
Yeah, Red Bull sent us twice, they failed the first time, a invite to this challenge, which was a circuit board that came in a box, and it was filled with Easter eggs.
Not literal Easter eggs, though.
No, wrong time of year. Close, but not quite. Hidden tricks and whatnot in the files and in the circuit board. And, so when it arrived, some people just started taking up work on it. Roger soldered it together because it didn't come quite complete and, started poking at it. And then I got involved. And then a little bit later, Nate got involved.
Yeah, it really ramped up in the course of just one night, as I recall. It was pretty exciting to witness, especially after we got the package something like, what, a week late?
Yeah, it was. We got it, everybody else got it Monday or the previous Friday, and we got it on Friday of that week. The first one got lost in the mail and has, to the best of my knowledge, completely disappeared. And then they priority shipped us a replacement.
He wants to bet that someone at the USPS basically just decided to open a box and was like, wow, this is really cool, and decided to keep this weird-looking gadget.
Yeah, they have no idea what it does.
Yes.
Or it was but freed it and determined neat. To be an explosive.
It could have been
that.
Yeah,
they probably blew it up.
Yes. And after you explode the invitation, you know, you get this fireworks display. And
We didn't try that. No.
I love the reaction. You know what we're going to do after this interview?
Yeah.
Sorry about your thing, Red Bull. That's okay.
It was a pretty cool invitation, though, but that really was just the teaser. I wasn't there when they did the big reveal about what the competition really was. Who was there? Was it?
A number of us were here. Actually, all of us were here at the space. And when it was big reveal, as in they updated their website with the rules, there wasn't anything.
And they told you what the competition was actually, what you would have to do inside of about 16 days.
But what it consisted of was somebody updated the website and somebody said, oh, hey, maybe I should click reload. And I was like, oh, look, the page looks different.
In fact, we didn't end up looking until like an hour late or something because we were all doing other stuff. And then somebody's like, oh, it's after 10 o'clock. And so we looked and read the rules, and they were very brief. They were
surprisingly open-ended, rules. Non-specific. Yeah. It was what you want to lay it out. The
take an object from the past, or take an invention or object from the past, reinvent it, improve it somehow, use an Arduino, and make it bigger than a bread box and smaller than a box truck. I think that was it.
Yeah. Could not be more than 4 or 5 sentences.
Yeah. And then we also learned through Red Bull, because there were like a rule set also, but like it was a 4-member team, which was kind of limiting from a hackerspace point of view, because hackerspaces don't typically work on discrete teams.
At least in our space, that's definitely the case. People glom onto a project, and they do what they want, and they stick around. It's the people who carry it forward who tend to be the core team, quote-unquote. But it worked out pretty nicely. I mean, the four of you guys did a really great job. So who wants to describe it? You had this really vague task ahead of you. What did you actually end up producing?
Well, we ended up producing the Chronotune, a time-traveling radio, and we should give credit. I believe Joe was the person who threw out the original idea for a time-traveling radio, Joe Bender.
Yeah, not even on the team. There was just, we're all kind of sitting around brainstorming, think of invention that we could do something with a car. We're going through, old patent filings and stuff. Well, let's see, in 1870, a washing machine was patented or whatever.
Yeah, ticker was thrown around.
Yeah, all sorts of things we couldn't really think of anything. And then it was like, oh, the radio. How about the radio? What could we do there? Oh, make it travel through time.
Nice. I like the idea that you guys are looking through patent documents as your inspiration for the past. That I guess that's a natural source if you're trying to update an invention.
Yeah, and you know, more ideas came after that, and we kept going back. That time traveling radio sounds like fun. And you know, after about 10 minutes of further idea generation, we all just were stuck on the time traveling radio and said, "Okay, that's our winner right there."
We kept coming back to it and still liked it. And that evening, I went and did some Googling to see if I could come up with anything similar, because it's always that pain when you come up with something that you think is an original idea, and you look and oh, it's been done 20 times. Son of a.
Yeah, it wasn't until after we finished it and the competition was over that I found a couple vaguely similar things. Something was done for like the BBC Museum or something that was vaguely similar, but it didn't have a lot of different recordings. It didn't have the,
And some people posted on like Boing Boing and stuff, "Hey, I made that thing X years ago," but there's like no information about it.
Right. Is just someone going, "Hey, that was my idea."
Basically.
I didn't get that sense at all. From, you know, I think it was it the Boing Boing comment, or was that the one that actually posted on our blog? I think it was actually posted in both places. But what I got from the guys posting was, "Oh, hey, you guys came up with the same idea. Here's my version." And, you know, I didn't get any sort of a, you know, a bitter feeling about it or anything. It was just, "Hey, you know, great minds think alike."
That's pretty cool.
But yeah, there was very little data about his version. You know, I don't think there was even a picture of the front of it. You can see the circuit boards. But, you know, don't know what it looked like, don't know if it worked.
Well, give us a little more data for our listeners out there about what the Corona Tune, it sort of does, and how it's different moving parts that you guys ended up putting inside of this thing.
So, it looks like an antique radio, specifically a Philco Model 7?
What is it? 70
Model 70? Either Model 70 or Model 90. The dial across the front of it, it's a big wide dial like you might see in an old 70s
it's a car
radio.
Pointer.
Yeah, rectangular pointer. But across the dial, instead of the frequency band, it's labeled in years, and you turn a knob, adjust the dial to a given year, and the audio you hear is contemporary with that year. So that's the idea. Instead of dialing a frequency, you dial up a period in time, and you hear audio from that time. Not more complicated than that. I think what makes it fun is kind of the fit and finish. It looks really good. We're starting to get lots of audio from lots of different years. There's a lot of little surprises in it that the dial extends into the future. We've recorded some little hilarious fictional bits for speculative events in the future.
And the very real ones of the past, like Skynet, I do hope, you know.
Oh, yeah, most definitely, yeah. And what else? The FM tuner. So if you tune to the present, you will hear, it will tune to a contemporary FM station, a real live FM station, and you can hear live audio from there. So all of these things together, kind of, it looks cool. It's a cool idea. And then you play with it a little bit longer and you keep finding little surprises in it. I think that's what makes it a big hit.
Yeah, it's loaded with Easter eggs of its own. And, that's something you can tell just from watching the advertisement. I will have to play a segment of the advertisement for the show, actually, because that whole production was a lot of fun. The response has been really positive. I mean, you guys have been getting a lot of email and a lot of requests to talk about the project. It seems like it's a real hit.
I mean, it made its rounds around the standard web posts or web pages for Nerdery, and there have been a handful of like media requests and whatnot asking about information and to get copies of the video and whatnot. So we'll see what of those pans out. It's still like early in the media cycle for stuff for print or video production stuff. But
and this is why people are always like, "Oh, that's on the news. Yeah, I read it on Slashdot 3 months ago."
Yeah.
Right. You got the speed of text on the internet versus video on television.
Yeah, and we're gonna get a lot of life out of this thing. I mean, I think we're gonna end up taking it to Maker Faire. I mean, we'll be schlepping this thing around for a year, taking it to whatever event we're going to.
It's unlike a lot of our previous group projects, it's small. You know, it is bigger than a bread box, but only slightly. So we can store it, you know, virtually forever. It's not like, you know, the various wheeled vehicles that have had to be dismantled just for space reasons.
The Twinkie car.
Yeah, the cupcake car. The cupcake car.
And, you know, for people who don't know, we also have a 16-foot tall fire-breathing statue made entirely out of duct tape and, you know.
Yeah, that's not something that you fold up in your briefcase and take to...
Only if you have a really big briefcase, but yes.
So instead, we hang it from our ceiling.
Yeah.
We hang everything from the ceiling.
Yeah. But, even right now, we're talking about making improvements to it, because, you know, for finishing the Red Bull competition, we had time limits that hampered us in fit and finish areas, and so we're refining
together.
The body to make it more appropriate. And then, you know, the software can still use improving, but I'm sure the software will always... be in the state of could use improving, yeah. Like any software.
Sure.
Oh, I can imagine. So, running right up to the wire, what was the thing that you were most concerned about functioning or delivering in the project?
For me personally, coming up to maybe 3 or 4 days before the deadline, I was convinced it wasn't going to come together in time. I felt like all the parts were probably going to be there, but we just didn't have the integration time left. Because there are a lot of disconnected parts that all needed to come together, mainly in software.
Yeah.
And I really didn't think that was going to happen.
Disconnected parts being built by different people with just a little different idea of how it was supposed to work.
Not a lot in the way of nailed down specification that you could work to here. It was just kind of, do that. Okay.
As an outsider, that's the thing that amazes me is how you guys were running and gunning with something like 16 days and you still got it together.
Yeah.
Well, to be fair, we had a pretty clear vision of how we wanted to operate from the very first night, from the very first day we had the idea. We knew everyone could kind of imagine what it was going to look like. And to contrast it with the Global Hackerspace Challenge thing, I think to this day, no two people who are working on it could agree on exactly what you guys were trying to achieve, right?
That's true, yeah. And that's something we'll cover in a different segment of the program. But to that point, simplicity is a virtue. You had a time-traveling radio. That was sort of the start and the stop of the idea, and you just figured out how to implement and deliver on that. You know?
Yeah,
It captured your imagination much more than a tool that was supposed to be flexible and general purpose, which is what we tried to do in the GGHC project here at i3 Detroit.
I think that that we ran into the normal problem of any competition like this, which is the front end, we worked very lightly on it, and then in exchange, we worked constantly for the last few days. I mean, literally.
Yeah.
You know.
All-nighters.
I had like 45 minutes of sleep in the last 50 hours of the competition. And
Eric has superhuman ability to go without sleep, man. I got like the flu in the last day and a half and just basically was worthless. But my hat's off to Eric for... The man's made of iron. I don't know how he does it.
He is literally made of iron, folks. Yeah, he's had his hip replaced. Yeah. He's working on his pelt. Yeah.
So I came in one day after going home just like, this was like my 45 minutes. I went home for 45 minutes. Well, I was gone for like 2 hours, but I slept for 45 minutes and came back, and suddenly there was the body of this thing sitting there, and while I was gone, they'd hammer together all the bits, and I'm like, holy crap, we have something that we can start coding. I just have to, like, finish wiring it up. And that was the first time that I was really like, we're actually going to get this done. And because when I came back, the video production group had set up and had started filming the commercial. Yeah. And that's when I was really stoked and felt like we were definitely going to get
it. Yeah, we should give maybe a little kid, probably...
Oh, yeah. A lot of credit.
Yeah, a lot of credit to Nick Britsky, Karen Corbeil. I don't know how to pronounce her last name. Yep. Corbeil.
The improv group.
Improv group. Oh, yeah. My wife is a does improv comedy at Go Comedy, Ferndale's finest improv comedy theater.
Go Comedy is really fucking hilarious. I'm just going to put that out there.
So we had a bunch of performers who came in, drank some beer, wrote some stuff to create some fictional audio tracks for in the future and far in the past from previous to when, you know, actually you can get actual real recorded audio. And we'll keep, and they want to do more. They want to come back and just add
That's
some more
great.
Stuff. Yeah, they've got some good ideas. Yeah.
And I think that could be something we could do with, you know, anybody who stops in the shop is like, okay, come here and record a spot.
Yeah.
But the fun thing about it was, you know, for the terms of the challenge, the device had to be created by the 4-person team that was registered. But, you know, the video about it, we had outside help with the, some of the content that was on it, the skits that are on it, we had outside help with. And
yeah, I was a little hesitant to publicize the fact that we were getting those guys to help create some content. In the end, it really didn't factor into our submission. It didn't show up into the, it didn't show into the submission that we made. So it didn't, I think it only adds to the project and wasn't a cheat in any sense.
And you didn't bring their help in really for the reinvention, which I think is the critical part, right? It was amazing for me to watch. I mean, you had this team. We have an electronics lab here at i3 Detroit with benches and a library of parts and different soldering stations, and they were more or less monopolized by several concurrent projects, but primarily Red Bull Creation. And then adjacent to our electronics lab, you have a kitchen. And I remember coming in one morning and finding all of the table and chairs and things pushed aside in the kitchen, and there was a podcasting set up there with these mic stands and a mixing board and all this gear that was brought in with the Go Comedy Club people who had been recording last minute. I mean, it was just all the aftermath of this torrent of energy that was just going through the space.
And I felt really bad about leaving the electronics lab a mess for a few days because, you know, we finished and submitted our video and we were just all done. We didn't have the energy to clean up. And, you know, I didn't
That's
get
a no-no.
Yeah, and that's, you know, at a hackerspace, that's a no-no. But I did, when I was leaving, I sent out an email. I'm like, sorry, guys, shove it aside if there's a problem. We'll be back in a day or two to clean up. And it was like 2 days, and I came back and started picking up. But, you know, after 50 hours, I just need to go home and sleep.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who produce projects like this would agree that, you know, you can make a mess and do mostly nothing, but if you at least produce an incredible project and then you leave a mess and you apologize for it and you clean it up later, that can be acceptable. Awesome. Well, do you guys have any parting thoughts about what the project was like to work on, what you have in mind, next steps for the Chronotune?
I thought it was an amazing project. I still love the idea, and I think that we could really, whether it's i3 or the larger nerdish community, could take it a lot further. It could be a legitimate education tool, you know, if produced correctly. As for us, I think we're working on polishing it up because it's in competition complete form. Like the requirements for the competition, which wasn't turning in an item, it was turning in a video about an item. So you know, we want to polish it up, get it all nice and pretty for Maker Faire and some other expo.
The World Steam Expo at the end of the month, which is in Novi, Michigan. Novi. If you are going to the World Steam Expo, you will see it there at some point. I don't know when.
It's a time traveling radio. It'll show up sometime.
It'll show up sometime in your life. Perhaps, you know, email us. We can have it appear at your deathbed. I don't know.
It's true. Yes, yeah. We can record your dying words.
Sure.
There's more to the competition as well, right? We're waiting to hear back from Red Bull about who's moving to the final chapter of this competition in New York, right?
Yes, Wednesday at noon, so probably before you're hearing this audio, they are announcing the winning 10 teams who will then go to New York in early July to compete. And we know very little. We know that it's a 72-hour competition in the streets of New York. And there are prizes, and that's basically all we know. They have been very vague. So we should find out. For us, it's right now. Tomorrow afternoon, we hope to find out, and hopefully we are going to New York. So far, we've heard great things from the Red Bull people. They are disconnected from the judges. The judges are judging on their own, so who knows? But based on the response that that we've gotten just in general, I'm really, really hopeful that that we will be selected.
As are we all. Any last thoughts, gents?
Another thank you to all the other i3 members that weren't involved, but were very tolerant and very supportive and create this great space that make this kind of thing possible. It really would not have been possible without this place and the facilities and all the people that make this place happen.
And I can't stress enough the thank you to the people who helped produce the commercial spot, because while our project submission is what it is, the publicity around it, I don't think we would have gotten, you know, even half of it if it wasn't for the great video to go with it.
Yeah. Little Easter egg, you can see, I think it's when I'm running my mouth at some point in the video, you can see, we were right down to the wire, literally like 15, 20 minutes before the video had to be submitted, we were still editing the video. And in fact, when I'm talking, being recorded for the video, you can see Karen editing the beginning of the actual video that you're watching. I don't even know how that's possible.
But will then be now?
Wait, I don't... You know, if we had some time-traveling device that could...
Wait a second.
Hang on a minute.
A time-traveling video editing rig.
Yesterday, we found from Red Bull that our Motley Screwballs will, in fact, be moving on to the next and final round of the contest. Congratulations to them for a strong showing, and best of luck to the teams who will duke it out in New York come July. Thanks again to Ben Chun, Nate Bizanson, Eric Merrill, and Ted Hansen for getting on the horn with me. I hope you enjoyed our program this month, dear listeners. Until next time.